Hi, this is Ken Robinson. Get ready for a great conversation. But remember, every Tuesday, there's a new edition of Audio Antiques from the K-Rob Collection, featuring highlights from the golden age of American radio on many of these same podcast platforms.
Welcome to the Ken Robinson Podcast. Get ready for conversation and information from the people who are making a difference. Hosted by veteran Hall of Fame radio and television journalist, Ken Robinson.
Well, hello everyone. Thanks for calling up my podcast and welcome to all our listeners in the United States and around the world. What are we going to talk about this time? Well, let's talk about athletics. You know, it's big business. But esports may be growing the fastest, with some well-established teams also competing online. What about taxes? Nobody likes to pay income taxes, but there are ways to make your tax return work in your favor. We'll find out how. Also, retirement. Let's take a look at retirement. Is it possible to save enough money to live a comfortable life when you get old? We'll try to answer that question. It's all coming up right after this break. Why spend a fortune on expensive imaging programs? Look no further. Introducing GIMP, the revolutionary open-source imaging software. With its user-friendly interface and powerful features, you'll be amazed at what you can create. Edit your pictures like a pro. Retouch your images flawlessly. And bring your creative vision to life. GIMP offers a wide range of tools and effects that will transform your ordinary photos into extraordinary works of art. Plus, GIMP's open source community means endless possibilities. Share your work, learn from others, and be part of a vibrant creative community that's always pushing boundaries. And the best part? GIMP is completely free. Say goodbye to expensive subscriptions and hello to unlimited creativity. Why wait? Download GIMP today. And join millions of satisfied users who have already discovered the power of open-source imaging software. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Ken Robinson. You know, our theme music was created by H Beats, who can make any presentation sound better with a custom musical track. Why not see what H Beats can do for your production? Just email hbeats330@gmail.com. That's hbeats with a Z. Esports is growing in popularity, but did you know it's been around for decades? The industry got its start way back in 1962 when computer scientist Steve Russell created the game Space War while at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
And I started promoting the idea that something that taught people how to fly a spaceship would be a good thing. The usual reaction was sort of like, yeah, you know, that's a really good idea. You know, somebody ought to do that. Somebody who really understands the idea. Why don't you do it? So I was shamed into writing some code.
Space War was used in the earliest known video game competition in 1972 at Stanford University. By 2015, esports had exploded, generating nearly $750 million in revenue worldwide. By 2018, it reached nearly $2 billion in revenue. And now, traditional sports teams are getting involved with leagues of their own. In February 2017, the National Basketball Association announced the creation of an esports league centering on the NBA 2K gaming franchise. Known as the NBA 2K League, it started competition in 2018. It was the first esports league to be operated by a North American professional sports league, and it's structured just like the NBA. Teams are operated by NBA franchises and feature five professional esports players. Let's find out more about that from Jonathan Summers, Senior Director of Digital Operations and Esports Partnerships for the 2016 champion Cleveland Cavaliers. Jonathan, just how big is esports today?
half a billion players worldwide. Between the ages of 14 and 34, it is quickly rising to that of the traditional sports levels, such as the NBA and NFL, in terms of interest of today's youth. And the NBA quickly recognized the growth of esports and formed the NBA 2K League. And we are one of 22 NBA franchises partaking in that league. You know, just a few years ago, this was an industry that only the endemics were partaking in, such as gaming chairs, hardware, peripherals, things of that nature. Now it's to the point where if a corporate entity is not involved in esports and gaming, they're kind of on the outside looking in. You know, gaming is one of the platforms that today's youth is most interested in addition to OTT platforms, social media, and gaming. And it's not necessarily gaming themselves, but also the viewership of gaming on platforms such as YouTube and Twitch. So we as an organization recognize that we need to get in front of today's youth, and if that's where they're spending a lot of their time, then we need to kind of meet them on their turf, if you will, and that's why we got involved in this industry.
Now, does that mean that the Cleveland Cavaliers and maybe other NBA teams or other major league sports teams are going to have esports teams in adjacent to their regular business?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, there are 22 NBA teams that are partaking in the NBA 2K League out of the 30, and we hope that that grows to the full 30. But what we also see is professional sports owners across both NFL, MLB, and NBA are also invested in other esports entities such as League of Legends, Overwatch, Call of Duty, etc., more at the investment and ownership level. But there's no doubt in my mind that in the upcoming months and years ahead, it will be, you will be in the minority if you are a professional sports franchise that does not have an esports division of your organization.
How does it operate? Does it operate like a traditional professional sports league or sports team? You know, you have your minor leagues, college, you know, whatever, and then people come up through the ranks as their skill develops?
So each game and each title is a little bit different. For the NBA 2K League in particular, it's an online tryout to participate in the league. Once you meet the league's qualifications, they put you into a virtual combine where all of these players play against one another online. We then scout those players, interview those players, and draft those players. The draft has been held at MSG and Barclays with Adam Silver himself introducing and greeting the first pick. What I would say is the NBA treats the 2K League like their fourth league. So they have the NBA, the WNBA, the G League, and the NBA 2K League. Along the same lines, we treat Cavs Legion Gaming Club as our fourth franchise. So we have the Cleveland Cavaliers, we have the Cleveland Monsters, we have the Canton Charge, and now we have Cavs Legion GC. So we treat it like we would treat it any other professional sports franchise, because that is what it is.
Now, is it like a professional sports franchise in the way that you have stars? Like, you know, the Cavaliers have Kevin Love, the Lakers have LeBron James. Who are the stars in esports?
Yeah, well, you know, there are two kind of different subsets of stars. There are streamers and entertainers, those that are more known for entertaining their audiences. You might have heard of Ninja, for example. He's a wildly popular player. He's more of a streamer and entertainer than a competitive player. And then, of course, you have the competitive side as well, and there are those across all of the games that are at the top of their level. I can tell you that for us in the NBA 2K League, we're very blessed. At Cavs Legion, we have the Defensive Player of the Year, Marcus Glenn, and we also have Tim Anselmo, who won an ESPY Award for Best Esports Moment just a few months ago. So we feel very confident in our leadership and those that are on our team, and that we're hoping that we can bring home a title in season three.
Now, this attracts thousands of people to stadiums where they watch esports. How does that work?
Absolutely. Yeah, I would recommend any listener, if they ever get an opportunity to go to watch an esports event in person. I went to one at the Barclays Center. It was my first. I had no idea what to expect. I walked in. It was sold out. It was 20,000 people, primarily between the ages of, I'd say, 10 to 35, standing, cheering, wearing the uniforms of their favorite players, buying their merchandise, getting their autographs. It was like you were at an NBA game. And it was just a mind-blowing experience. So, yes, venues sell out all across the country and all across the world, for that matter. Upwards of, you know, 100 million people watch the League of Legends World's Finals, which are traditionally held in Asia and streaming there. So, yes, if you ever have the opportunity to go see an event in person, I highly recommend it.
I haven't seen one. I've heard about these events. What do you watch? I mean, you're not looking at players on a court.
You're looking at a big screen? Is that how it works?
Yeah, traditionally the competitors are on a stage, usually sitting amongst one another, and then obviously you'll see the game that they're playing up on the scoreboard, for example. And so while they're not physically partaking in a game, of course, because it is esports, the thrill, the excitement, the energy of the crowd is the same. I mean, it was deafening when I went. I couldn't even hear myself think. That's how into it the crowd is. And I know that this seems a little different, obviously, to a traditional sports fan who isn't familiar with this. But what I would say is, you know, just a few years ago, you know, if you turn on ESPN, you wouldn't see poker or bowling or, you know, anything of that nature. People want to watch other people do what they do, but at a higher level, right? When I go to a Cavs game, I enjoy seeing Kevin Love play the same game that I play, but at a much higher level. It's the same thing with competitive esports and gaming. The relatability between today's youth and the professionals is there because professional esports athletes tend to be in between, you know, the 18 to 25 range. So they're not that far removed from the demographic of fans that are watching them play. So the relatability is there and the ability to understand completely what you're watching and go home and play the same game yourself is very unique.
Does it only appeal to young people? Because there are a lot of people that were around, you know, who started gaming when they had arcades and games like Frogger and Crash Bandicoot
and
Mario.
You know, I've been involved within esports for just a couple years now, and the number one thing that I have taken away since day one is there is no barrier of entry. And you can be old, young, big, small, any ethnic background. It doesn't matter. You know, you can be an old guy in a suit and tie, and there's probably an old Atari game that you would enjoy playing. Or you could be a 14-year-old, and you can enjoy playing Fortnite. Gaming is gaming, and gaming is a safe and fun environment where you can draw life lessons such as teamwork and camaraderie, and everything that you would learn from traditional sports, you can learn in esports as well. So, you know, there's a lot of kids out there who might not be big or fast, and they can't make their basketball or football team, but you know what? They can find success and happiness gaming, and really that's, again, goes back to what we're trying to do as an organization, is we're not trying to exclude anyone. We're trying to reach everybody within Northeast Ohio and the state of Ohio and beyond, and gaming affords us the ability to do that.
Now, I know where I can get tickets to an NBA game. I know where the games are. I know where the stadiums are. How do I find an esports competition?
Well, again, it varies by game and title. So similar to MLB, NFL, NBA are all different. Same with esports. So Overwatch, Call of Duty, League of Legends, NBA 2K League are all vastly different from one another. A young individual who plays Fortnite might not play 2K, or an individual who plays Rocket League might not play Overwatch. You know, esports and competitive gaming is not to be lumped within one bucket. It's really a silo of different buckets, if you will. As far as watching the games, they tend to occur at major venues all across the country. I can tell you the NBA 2K League in particular plays at a studio in New York City that the NBA built a few years ago. It's a state-of-the-art facility. I highly recommend anybody to go check it out. You're just a few feet from the action. It's very entertaining. A lot of trash talking going on. It's not what you would expect. But to answer your question, you know, it really depends on the game. But major sports venues are more and more hosting these events, such as MSG, Barclays, Staples Center, and on it goes.
You can see a lot of these competitions on television now. They're being televised on a lot of channels.
Yeah. You know, on linear, it's starting to get a little bit more prevalent. But for now, predominant majority of competitive esports can be viewed online, which makes sense when you consider the audience that's typically viewing these events. So the major platforms, of course, are Twitch, Mixer, and YouTube. Those are kind of the big three, if you will. But yes, they are permeating more into linear television. Many of the events have occurred on Turner, as one channel in particular that have aired these events.
So how far do you think this is going to go? I mean, you know, some people may say, well, I think it's just a fad, but it looks like it's too many people
to be a
fad.
You know, there's an old saying, when you win the kids, you win. And if you want to know, you know, there's another old saying here, I don't want to use two cliches back, but you don't skate to where the puck is, you skate to where the puck is going. And when you look around, I can speak for Northeast Ohio, that there are dozens of high schools in Northeast Ohio alone that have formed gaming clubs and competitive teams that are now competing against one another. And that has also seen itself in the collegiate ranks as well. You know, we're fortunate to be partnered with Kent State University and their esports program, where they have 30 competitive athletes competing across a variety of titles. And now these universities are playing against one another. So this is definitely not a fad. It's definitely not a bubble. I firmly believe that, you know, in a year's time, if not shorter, when you're walking around Northeast Ohio, you'll see a young high school kid with a varsity jacket, and it will say football, basketball, and esports, or baseball, soccer, Overwatch. Because, you know, it's the phrase that it's not a traditional sport or it's not mainstream, that's over with. When you look at the numbers, it's already mainstream. I think it's just time for everybody to recognize that.
Now, can you make big money like a Kawhi Leonard or a LeBron James if you're really good?
You can. Yeah, absolutely. Those at the highest levels, both on the competitive side and on the streaming entertainment side, make, you know, high six figures, if not millions of dollars. You know, their compensation can come in the form of endorsements. It can come in the form of Twitch subscriber revenue. It can come in the form of prize revenue garnered at competitions. So yes, there is definitely a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, which is why a lot of kids who have made it, you know, look back and laugh and said, hey, see mom, see dad, you told me to get outside and stop being in the basement. Well, look at me now.
So a lot of parents shouldn't roll their eyes if their kids say, hey, I'm going into esports.
Well, you know, life is all about balance, right? I mean, I wouldn't advise anybody to focus 100% of their time and effort on competitive gaming and esports, you know, nor would I encourage anybody to focus 100% of their time and effort on any one thing. I think diversity is good. I think you should get outside and play and run around. We're very proud to be the professional esports franchise of Northeast Ohio and Cleveland. You know, you can find out all information for us on social media at Cavs Legion GC.
Good.
All right, thank you.
Great, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Jonathan Summers, Senior Director of Digital Operations and Esports Partnerships for the Cleveland Cavaliers of the National Basketball Association. Up next, how to get the most out of your income tax return. We'll find out right after this timeout. For decades, Wikipedia has been a beacon of unbiased, free knowledge for everyone. It's a place where facts triumph over fiction, and information is shared without any hidden agenda. But maintaining this incredible resource requires your help. Wikipedia is run entirely on donations from people like you. Your contribution, no matter how big or small, can make a world of difference. By donating to Wikipedia, you empower millions of individuals to access reliable information, learn about diverse cultures, and expand their horizons. You can help ensure that knowledge remains free and accessible to everyone, regardless of their background or location. So, as a former Wikipedia editor, I ask you to join us in supporting this invaluable platform. Visit donate.wikipedia.org today. In 2019, nearly 156 million income tax returns were filed in the United States. Of course, citizens in many other countries also have to file tax returns as well. Doing so can be simple or complex, depending on your particular situation. A while ago, I spoke with Bob Cox, a district manager for H&R Block, a tax preparation company operating in Canada, the United States, Australia, and India. The company was founded in 1955 by brothers Henry and Richard Block. Now, there's always an income tax filing deadline, and I asked Bob, who is the most likely to file late?
Well, obviously, people that feel they're going to owe money or historically owe money every year, they generally will file late.
You mentioned most Americans receive refunds. Well, what's the average refund?
Numbers that the IRS has indicated vary from year to year. Roughly $1,500 to $1,600 is the average refund, though, for individuals that come in the first couple months of the season.
What tends to be the biggest deduction?
Biggest deduction probably early in the tax season. There is a number of credits. One of them is called an earned income credit, earned income tax credit, and quite a few taxpayers have earned income tax credit. And That is what's called a refundable credit. In other words, that can actually be refunded to you even if you have paid little or no taxes into the system. And so a lot of people, and especially in January and early February, do have the earned income tax credit.
Are there any deductions, individuals or small business owners, or maybe people that have like a home part-time business, often fail to take?
You know, obviously there are quite a few deductions in the tax laws that individuals need to be aware of. Certainly here with a couple weeks ago in the tax season, there are not a lot of things you can do. However, if you do have an IRA set up, or even if you don't, you still have to April 17th to set up an IRA account, of course, if you would qualify for one. Self-employed individuals can also set up a retirement plan called a KEO plan. Now, of course, that has to be set up by the end of December. However, they can still contribute to that plan up to April 17th. And the last couple weeks here, you just want to make sure that you go through all your canceled checks and be sure to pick up all your contributions and any mortgage interest or home equity interest that you've paid. Medical deductions is something that many people do not qualify for because of the limitation they put on them, but nevertheless, you should add those up and see if it's able to help you at all.
And we've been hearing that a lot of refunds have been delayed by the IRS because they're checking returns more closely this year?
Yes, that's correct. Two major things have taken place with the Internal Revenue this year. The first thing is they are matching up all Social Security numbers, and that is for the spouses, for primary taxpayers, as well as for all the children. And if the returns show that, for example, a woman hasn't changed her name maybe when she got married at Social Security, or a child's name on the tax return doesn't match the name on Social Security records, the returns are being rejected if they're electronic returns and will be delayed if they are paper returns until the Internal Revenue can verify that the information is accurate. Part of the anti-fraud campaign, they are doing a thorough review of returns that have earned income tax credit on it. And in many cases, they are delaying refunding that money to individuals until they do a thorough review. So the number one thing, the matching up the Social Security numbers, and the second thing, earned income tax credit, has resulted in a number of taxpayers in the country having their refunds delayed.
Is the IRS more apt to do audits this year than in years past because of we heard that they're looking to crack down on fraud?
Well, the Internal Revenue, of course, is always interested in reducing fraud, as I think most taxpayers in this country are. Most taxpayers, I think, are honest people that want to pay their fair share and resent any fraud that takes place out there. And, of course, there's always fraud. I can't speak for the IRS other than to say that they are concerned about reducing fraud, and they've taken a big step this year, as I mentioned, in regards to the earned income tax credit to try to reduce fraud in that area, which is historically a pretty heavy area for fraudulent returns being found.
Now, when folks come to you with their information for their tax return, do they often bring the right information? Do they have the right receipts? Or do folks need to do better record keeping throughout the year?
I think I find in a number of cases, be it when taxpayers initially come in or follow-up calls that taxpayers get down the road from Uncle Sam to come in for a little audit, I think generally we find that the documentation is a little weak. People have legitimate deductions, and, of course, when they come to a tax preparation firm like H&R Block or anybody else, we are not the Internal Revenue. Of course, we don't audit them at that point. We simply indicate to them what the legal deductions and credits are that they're entitled to, and then also indicate they do have to be able to document them, substantiate them. But I think there are individuals that do not keep very good records sometimes, and that can be a problem down the road if they aren't able to document their legitimate deductions.
What's the best way to avoid an audit?
What's the best way to avoid an audit? Since much of the audit procedure is random, or it's based on criteria that the Internal Revenue does not necessarily share with everybody, I don't know of any way to avoid an audit other than to simply say that if you are audited, just be able to come up with the documentation, invoices, bills, canceled checks, and so forth to substantiate your deductions, and you'll be in good shape.
I've always heard that taxpayers that fit a certain profile are more likely to be audited. Is that true?
I believe the Internal Revenue and in different things that they put out will point out that your chances are greater if you, for example, earn over $100,000 a year. There are certain areas that Internal Revenue looks closely at. Deductions such as office in the home tend to be get a little more attention when that shows up on a return. There are certain parameters that the Internal Revenue looks at. They look at your deductions. For example, they might look at your contributions relative to your total income to determine if it's reasonable or if it's within certain parameters that they've established. That does not mean that you don't want to take something that you're legally entitled to take as a credit or a deduction, but just be aware if it's something that is extraordinarily high as a percentage of your total income, that it could be questioned down the road.
All right, and are mathematical errors usually the most common errors that people make?
Ken, it's interesting you mention that, because years ago, before people started electronically filing tax returns, the IRS would say anywhere from 10 to 20% of the returns they'd get in sometimes had math errors on them. Nowadays, with the electronic filing of tax returns that we do at H&R Block and a lot of people in the industry do, as well as people having home computers, math errors are a smaller percentage. Obviously, the computer will make fewer errors than you or I would. So that's been reduced in recent years. But there are still returns that somehow get through that are maybe mathematically incorrect.
All right. And finally, we're hearing more talk out of Washington coming calling for tax reform as far as filing goes. There's one presidential candidate who's calling for basically a flat tax with only two deductions. There's always been this talk about a flat tax. Some say we should go to a sales tax. Do you see any of these proposals becoming law anytime in the near future?
Of course, I'm not privy to what goes on in the White House or in Congress, but I think over the years the tax system has become such an integral part of our economy, whether it be deducting interest on a home you buy or breaks that you may get as being self-employed individual, whatever. I think it's difficult. Obviously, you can't make everybody happy, but I think it's difficult to try to simplify the system too much too quickly. Obviously, in my business, I think it would eventually cause me to lose some employees and see our business affected seriously. But I don't see how much can happen, you know, too quickly. But yeah, there are a lot of discussions going on right now, and the value-added tax or a sales tax or a flat tax, and we'll just kind of have to see what Congress decides.
Bob Cox, District Manager for H&R Block. If you get an income tax refund, should you save it for retirement? We'll get advice from widely respected financial expert Susie Orman right after this. This message is for all the individuals, businesses, and organizations seeking freedom from costly software licenses. LibreOffice is here to save the day. It's the open source Office suite, offering you a powerful and versatile package without the hefty price tag. It's time to break free from the chains of expensive computer programs and embrace a world of possibilities. With LibreOffice, you get everything you need to create stunning documents, spreadsheets, presentations, and more. It's compatible with all major file formats, ensuring seamless collaboration with others. Join millions of satisfied users who have made the switch to LibreOffice. Visit LibreOffice.org today and download this incredible suite free of charge with no obligation and no ads. Updates are also free, so you'll always stay ahead of the game. LibreOffice from the Document Foundation.
You are listening to the Ken Robinson Podcast with Hall of Fame broadcaster Ken Robinson.
Welcome back to the podcast. You know, it's always good to start saving for retirement early so you have enough money to enjoy life. But will those funds be there when you really need them? Let's find out from Susie Orman. She's a financial advisor and best-selling author. One of her many best-selling books is entitled, You've Earned It, Don't Lose It, Mistakes You Can't Afford to Make When You Retire. In 1987, she founded the Susie Orman Financial Group and began hosting her own financial literacy program on CNBC in 2002. Glad to have you here, Susie.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I know what I'm going to do when I retire. I'm going to take the money and I'm going to blow it on a new sports car. I'm not going to let the hospital and the nursing home take all my cash.
I have to tell you, that's what a lot of people do, believe it or not. They don't know it, but they might not be planning for it, but that somehow they end up doing it. You get older, you become 50 or 60, and you want a new car because you need one, and it takes all of your extra cash. And before you know it, your retirement funds have gone to be spent on a car. So I can't tell you how many people do exactly what you say inadvertently, but it ends up happening to them.
Well, it's a terrible fear that all the money you've worked hard to save up for a comfortable lifestyle, and you're worried about the possibility of being hit by a debilitating illness or going into a nursing home or going into some serious medical care.
And you should be worried about it. One out of three people listening to this station today will spend some time in a nursing home after the age of 65. Those are high statistics. Number one. Number two, your health insurance will not pay for a long-term care stay. Medicare will not pay for a long-term care stay. So at the time in life when you should be enjoying yourself and having your money, all of a sudden you go into a long-term care facility, there goes your money because you're the one who's going to end up paying for it. There's a way to protect yourself, however, and that's what this book is about. Mm-hmm. This book isn't about how to save for retirement. It's not going to tell you, take $100 and put it here and give it to some commission broker to make money off of you. What it's going to tell you is how to literally save your retirement. And it's going to tell you how to do that in words that you can understand. The book reads like a novel. People hate to put it down because it's a financial book that you can, for the first time in your life, relate to and understand. Mm-hmm. So the way that you save your retirement, one way is by buying a long-term care insurance policy. Perfect age to buy it is in your 50s. Why? Because the premium, what it's going to cost you per year, is based on how old you are when you purchase the policy. And it stays stable at that rate for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So a 50-year-old will spend $655 a year every year for the rest of his or her life for a Cadillac policy. If you wait till you are 60 to buy the same policy, it'll be $1,800 a year. If you wait till you are 70 to buy that exact same policy, it'll cost you almost $3,300 a year.
It's out of your reach by then,
that's
basically.
Right. So don't wait till you get older. And for those of you out there who think that you can sit back because you're going to inherit money from mommy and daddy, and there's a lot of you out there, whether you want to admit it or not, we all think about that. Chances are you're not going to get to inherit any money from mommy and daddy because they're going to lose it all to a nursing home stay. So if you want to protect them, if you want to protect your own inheritance, look into this book, look into the chapter on long-term care insurance, and make sure it's something you do when you're in your 50s rather than waiting.
Now, what does long-term care insurance do exactly? Does it? How does it keep you from having to lose all your hard-earned money?
It pays for your stay. If it's a good policy and you want to make sure that you have a good policy, 10 years ago, these policies weren't worth the paper they were written on. Today, there are many, many good policies out there. Again, the book gives explicit guidelines on how you can find one because you don't want to get taken here. Mm-hmm. But the way that it works is that they'll pay a specific amount of money every day, like the policy that I just quoted for $655 a year. Would be this policy if we were to purchase it today. They would pay you $100 a day today if you were to go into a nursing home. And it will pay you that whether you have Alzheimer's. It doesn't matter why you go into a nursing home. It doesn't matter what level of nursing home you go into. It can be a skilled nursing home facility where you literally can't do anything and you have around-the-clock nurses. Or it can be simply a nursing home where you need custodial help because you can't feed yourself or go to the bathroom or things like that. Mm-hmm. So it'll pay you $100 a day starting today. That $100 will go up 5% compounded every year for the rest of your life. It will pay you that for your entire lifetime. So if you went into a nursing home today and spent 50 years in a nursing home before you died, you would get your $100 a day plus that 5% compounded interest every year for the rest of your life. It will pay it from the very first day that you go in. You don't have to wait for not 3 months with you paying for it out of your own pocket. They'll pay the first day you go in, and they'll pay for 5 years at home. So if you happen to want to be at home mm-hmm. for home health care, it will pay you $50 a day for home health care, compounded inflation included for that.
Now, we don't hear very much about long-term care insurance, but it seems like it's just as important or maybe even more important than life insurance, which agents tend to push a lot.
You just hit it. Agents push whole life insurance because there are tremendous commissions in whole life insurance. In long-term care insurance, the commissions are very little. Think about it. $655 a year. The agent will probably get the first year 40% of that, or $250 the first year. And then every year thereafter, their commission will be about maybe $50 a year. There's no money in long-term care insurance. Therefore, your agents don't want to spend all this time trying to sell you something that there's really very little commission on. A whole life policy, if your premium is $3,000 a year, they're going to get $1,500 or somewhere around there. There's a big difference between $1,500 and $200 or $300 in commissions.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned folks should start looking to buy long-term care insurance while they're young,
maybe in their
40s, 50s, or maybe sooner. But we often don't think of that. We say, well, I'm not going to get sick, or that's so far away. I have 40, 50 years to plan for that.
That's the problem we have in our life. We procrastinate, and we think that we have more time than we do. You see, if we had crystal balls that could say, yes, tomorrow we're going to get ill, or this is going to happen to us 40 years from now, we would be fine, but we don't. Mm-hmm. So my favorite saying is, it's not if you're going to die, it's when you're going to die. It's not only about long-term care insurance, it's about wills. Do you have a will?
Yeah.
Do you have a trust?
No, I don't have a trust.
Right, so there's things that we put off that we know. Now, you've heard about trust for a long time,
mm-hmm.
haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Have you been thinking about getting one?
You know, it's always in the back of my head, but I never get around to doing anything about it.
All right. So that's what this whole book is about, to stop the procrastination, because we don't have time to procrastinate because we don't know when it will happen. Mm-hmm. This book was written because the people who are the stories in this book procrastinated, and then it was too late. They didn't have long-term care insurance. They lost all their money. They didn't have a trust. They ended up paying $235,000 in estate taxes because they didn't have a trust when they could have gotten away without having to pay a penny. One person didn't have a durable power of attorney for health care, which allows you to actually, if you go on life support systems, to designate who's going to pull the plug. Mm-hmm. So there are people who are still alive for 8 years today on life support, and their wives can't do a thing about it. So that's right. We don't think it will happen to us for 40 or 50 years, but it could. There are little things that you need to do that your financial advisor never tells you about because there's really no commissions involved with if you have a will, a durable power of attorney for health care, if you pay off your credit cards. Those things don't affect somebody else's life. They affect your life. And that's what this book is about. Your life, saving your life, and making sure that you get, here we go, I'm choked up about this, that you get to live the quality of life that you deserve to live when you are 60, 70, 80, and probably 90 years of age, because my dears, that's about how long you're going to live today.
All right, we're talking to Susie Orman, who's a certified Certified accountant?
Actually, a certified financial planner.
Financial planner, okay.
However, a real consumer activist and somebody who wants to make sure that the people out there are okay when they get older.
All right, and she's author of the book, You've Earned It, Don't Lose It. Nursing home insurance, is that a good idea? Is it a good idea to buy nursing home insurance?
Nursing home insurance is the same as long-term care insurance.
Okay.
What you really want is, besides long-term care insurance and the durable power of attorney for health care, mm-hmm. is you want to start thinking about things like trust and wills. You want to think about things like who's investing your money for you.
Mm-hmm.
All of us want a guardian angel. We want somebody who we can give our money to, and that person will take care of us. And we then don't want to be bothered with it after that. Well, my dears, once again, very few people will ever care about your money more than you.
Isn't that the truth?
If somebody else loses your money for you, your life is the one affected, not theirs. So the day has come when commissions and investment advice have got to be separated. If your advisor makes commission off of the advice that he or she gives you, you have to seriously wonder, are they giving you advice for your good, or are they giving you advice for their good? So you might want to look for a financial advisor if you feel that you need help, who you pay on an hourly basis, or they get a fee for what they do, a percentage. But you want to know that when they tell you something, that they don't really care if you do it or not. They want you to do it because it would be good for you. But they're not going to make their living based on the fact if you follow their instructions.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it too late for, let's say, someone who's listening in their 60s, 70s, 80s, or even 90s? And if they haven't done any planning, they haven't bought any long-term care insurance, they haven't made the necessary, maybe they have a will and that's about it, and they're hoping that, well, you know, things will just fall into the right place. Is it too late for them? Are they doomed?
No, nobody's ever too doomed. It's never too late to start. It's never too early to begin. For those of you, at least what you should do is have a forget the long-term care insurance if you're in your 80s or 90s. It's already too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
However, what you can do are things such as you should have a trust.
Okay, explain exactly what a trust is.
Well, to explain a trust, let's briefly first explain a will.
Okay.
A will is simply a document that states who you want to get your property when you die. So, my mother wants to leave me her house. She designates so in her will. When she dies, however, she's not alive to be able to sign the deed of her house over to me. So, therefore, I have to take the will down to a court and go through a procedure called probate. Probate literally means proving the will, authenticating it. So after the judge decides that this will is valid, then he or she will then take the steps to sign the house over to me for my mother, since my mother has died. For that simple procedure, there are probate fees, which consist of lawyer fees, executor fees, court expenses. It could cost you tens of thousands of dollars to have that little simple procedure done. If you simply do a trust while you are alive today, you simply transfer the property while you are alive into the name of the trust. So it would be, my mother's name is Anne, the Anne Orman Living Revocable Trust, Anne Orman Trustee, which means my mom has total control over her house and her money. She can change it anytime she wants, and she could change her mind as to if she wants to leave it to me or not. However, it's held in trust for me when she dies. So she's already taken the steps during her lifetime to transfer the name of the house into the trust for my benefit. So when she dies, there are no probate fees, there are no expenses, because the house goes immediately to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's simply a living revocable trust. Those avoid probate. All of us should want to avoid probate.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who have estates over $600,000, you want what's called a marital trust or an AB tax planning trust. That will save you up to $235,000 if you have $1.2 million or more in your estate. So there are many different kinds of trust. Again, the book gives explicit guidelines on how to find a lawyer who has your best interest at heart, what that lawyer should do for you, and how much that lawyer should charge you for a trust.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of married couples and other folks, maybe relatives who have bought a home or own property together, maybe they own it, they have co-ownership of it, and they believe that if one passes away, that share automatically goes to the surviving owner. But does it really work out that way? Is that enough safeguard? Or?
Between husband and wife, you're right, it works that way. But let me tell you what happens usually with joint tenancy. Husband and wife, first marriage, own a home, and they have children. Everything's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
The husband dies. And wife gets the house totally in her name. She owns it. Her will states that when she dies, everything that she owns is to go to her children. Fine. A few years later, she meets another man. She gets married. And they put that house in joint tenancy because she wants to make sure that her husband has a place to live if she dies first. But she feels like her will says everything goes to her children when she dies, so she knows her children are taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
She dies. The house goes over to her new husband totally in his name alone. His will, however, says that his children are to get everything. When he dies, her children are totally blocked out because it goes by his will, not hers. So sometime owning things in joint tenancy, your assets don't necessarily end up where you think they're supposed to end up.
Sounds like a real nightmare.
It can be a real nightmare, especially for the children. In the book, there's a story about Carol and Joe, whose parents, they grew up in this house. The house was supposed to be theirs, and the house ended up going to the wife's children, the second wife's children, and not to them. And they couldn't understand why that happened when the will said, but it was supposed to come to us. Joint tenancy overrides the instructions of any will. So make sure, especially with the second marriage or something, that you know what you're doing.
All right. Well, we want to thank you for joining us today to talk about these vital issues. Certified financial planner and author Susie Orman.
She's written 9 New York Times bestsellers about personal finance. She was named twice to the Time 100 list of influential people. She's won 2 Emmy Awards, 8 Gracie Awards. She's co-produced and hosted 8 PBS specials. She's appeared on multiple additional television shows. She's been a guest on the Oprah Winfrey Show about 29 times and Larry King Live over 30 times. She's currently host of the Susie Orman Women and Money podcast. Well, I hope you found this podcast interesting and informative. If you did, tell your friends and feel free to subscribe. Thanks so much for listening. People often ask me, what audio editing software do I use to produce my podcasts? Well, the answer is easy. Audacity, the free and user-friendly audio editing software that puts professional quality tools at your fingertips. With Audacity, you can easily cut, copy, and paste audio clips, making editing a breeze. Need to remove background noise or enhance the clarity of your recordings? Audacity has you covered with its powerful noise reduction and equalization features. From reverb and echo
to pitch correction and beyond,
Audacity empowers you to unleash your creativity. Audacity is available for download at no cost, making it accessible to everyone, from podcasters and musicians to students and hobbyists. So why wait? Take control of your audio editing needs with Audacity today. Visit audacityteam.org to download your free copy and join the millions of satisfied users like me who trust Audacity for their audio editing needs. Welcome to Ken's Corner. I'm Ken Robinson. What does it take to be a TV meteorologist? Channel 3's Michael Estime says, an understanding of science and lots of patience.
And I think to be a meteorologist on TV, you have to understand going into this that this is an inexact science because it is ever-changing. No 2 days are alike. To try to create a best forecast that you can, it's a challenge that you willingly accept each and every day. So a challenging career, absolutely, I wouldn't change it for the world.
Now, what about the young people who might want to get into the field of meteorology? What should they do?
It is ever-changing. So if there is a student out there, or someone in Northeast Ohio, that especially one of the kiddos that wake up early Saturday morning and there's a ton of snow and then there's a layer of ice underneath all that, and that just, you know, gets their juices flowing and they're over the moon excited about it, follow your passion. And I speaking from experience, it's a passion like that for me that ended up turning into a wonderful profession. And know that you'll have to study hard. Know that schooling is not going to be easy. But if, you know, if you're looking for the easy way out, then a career in meteorology might not be it. But if you're up for the challenge, if you are up for the skill and the precision that it takes, the patience that it takes to be a meteorologist, and I think you should go full speed ahead for it.
Can it be stressful at times?
The simple and honest answer is absolutely.
WKYC-TV3 meteorologist Michael Estime.
Thanks for stopping by Ken's Corner. And please subscribe to our podcast series, The Ken Robinson Shows.